Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about the world of insects with PJ Leash back with us once again. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He has degrees in biological sciences and entomology. So we'll talk about mosquitoes for sure and Japanese beetles for sure. And, of course, we'll take your bug-related questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and certainly love to hear from you. And PJ Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Good to be here, Larry.
So let's talk about mosquitoes first. Are there some things that most of us don't know about mosquitoes?
Well, one of the things that comes to my mind right away is that worldwide there's over 3,000 different species of mosquitoes, and we have close to 60 different species here in Wisconsin alone. So it's not one single creature, it's a whole bunch of different species, and each species differs in its biology and habits and if it can carry a disease and what type of animals it likes to feed on. We have some mosquitoes, for example, that as adults never take a blood meal, so we wouldn't necessarily consider them pest species.
So I know there are some people who say, what the heck are they worth? Is there a purpose for a mosquito?
Well, from their point of view, I would say they're simply trying to continue on and perpetuate their species. Out in the ecosystem, they will serve as food for other animals. That could be other insects or vertebrates in some cases. Certain fish and birds might eat them from time to time and that sort of thing. So they are a food source for other creatures, so they do play that role in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty good role, too. Are there places on Earth where you can't find a mosquito?
Well, they are pretty widely distributed. The main thing about mosquitoes, though, is they are associated with water. The larvae are aquatic, and so they need some type of water to develop in. And a lot of cases, they don't need a whole lot of water to do so. But if you are in a very, very dry environment, you're either not going to have mosquitoes or not many mosquitoes simply because there's not a whole lot of free water available. Versus if you went to a location where you have lots of water and warm temperatures, that can be very, very good mosquito habitat.
Yeah, I read somewhere where if a bottle cap full of water and left sitting can produce up to 10 mosquitoes. Is there any truth to that?
There is, yes. So I just mentioned that those larvae, they need water to develop in. They are truly aquatic creatures in that juvenile stage, the larvae and the pupae. And most mosquitoes as larvae are going to be feeding on organic debris, things like fallen leaves and stuff like that. So if you had a bottle cap full of water with a little bit of plant debris in there from a part of a dead leaf or grass clipping or something like that, that's everything that they need to develop. And so it would simply be a matter of time. It's going to be influenced by how warm it is, but you're absolutely right. That could easily breed, maybe a dozen or even more mosquitoes in that very, very tiny bit of water.
Yeah, just goes to show you want to keep your water. Don't let water standing, I guess is probably a good way to look at it. Now, I always have been told that the female is the only one that bites. Is that true?
That is correct. So if you're being bitten by a mosquito, you know that is a female. The females of many species need that blood meal to get enough nutrients to be able to produce her batch of eggs. There are some mosquitoes where the females don't need a blood meal at all, but when you think about male mosquitoes, they're really interested in mating, and then when they go to feed, they're going to flowers for a nectar source to get those sugars. So the males don't bite you at all. It's the females that do the blood sucking.
What do we do to keep mosquitoes out? You know, you've got people coming over. You're going to be outside, of course, because of COVID, or just because you want to be outside. And here we are in the backyard. How do you keep the mosquitoes away?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of different things that we can all do in our own backyards. And the first thing I would mention is that everyone's yard and situation is slightly different from everyone else. Some of the things we can do, and we just touched on this, Larry, but that notion of standing water, and it doesn't need to be much. So this could be something like a kid's toy in the sandbox that collects a little bit of water, and if it sits there for a week or two, that might breed mosquitoes. But looking around your yard for water sources, this could be a bird bath, and if you're changing out that water about once a week this time of the year or more frequently, that would eliminate any mosquitoes that are developing in there. Same kind of thing with kiddie pools. In my own backyard, we've got a little blue plastic kiddie pool we put out for the dogs, and if that sits there for about a week and leaves fall in it, you can see mosquito larvae in there, so we have to dump that out and put fresh water in. Could be a clogged gutter, could be even a tarp you might have over a firewood pile that some water pools in and sits there. That could breed mosquitoes. So looking for standing water like that and reducing it or eliminating it, that's one very helpful approach, because if that water remains, that could be breeding spots for mosquitoes right in your own backyard. So getting rid of water can be a very helpful approach. Some other things that can help, mosquitoes of many species like to rest on dense vegetation. So if you have a lot of overgrown shrubs and things like that, getting in there and removing some of those or thinning things out and getting more airflow in there might help to a certain extent. Some other things you can do in your backyard would be use personal protective measures, long sleeve clothing. Now, this isn't necessarily feasible if it's 90 degrees out. We don't want to have on jeans and a long sleeve flannel. But if it's a more mild temperatures, those long sleeves are a physical barrier between yourself, your skin, and the mosquito. So that can be very helpful. We've got all of our repellents, the DEET, Picaridin, oil of lemon, eucalyptus, and things like that. And I really suggest using EPA registered repellents, because these are repellents that have the scientific data associated with them showing that they actually work. And then a few other things that can be helpful would be using physical barriers. I just mentioned long sleeve clothing as a barrier between your skin and mosquitoes, but something like staying indoors if they're really bad or sitting in a screened in porch can be a very effective way. Although outdoors, we can do some other things like setting up a box fan or two to get some air movement with their small body mass. They're not particularly strong flyers if there's a decent breeze. That can help keep them at bay. So something as simple as setting out a box fan can really help on your back deck.
Yeah, I've got that on our front porch. And so in the evenings, if the mosquitoes start coming, I just turn on the box fan, and that really seems to do the job. Well, we have a number of people online waiting to ask you questions, PJ. So I think we'll go to the phones, and let's go to Chris in Black Creek first. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mr. Mueller, and to your guest, Larry, it's me again, Chris Sander, crystalsforkids.org. I did a test on the Asian beetle on a farm in Baraboo that I lived at for 14 years. And in the wintertime, the one was starving for water, so I put a drop of water on the counter, and I could literally see it suck up the drop of water. So I went and I put my finger next to the beetle, and it pushed back at me, and these two little tiny droplets of stink fluid came out on each side of its head, and I thought, wow. So I dissected, and sure enough, on the inside of its head, it has a dark a kind of a red sac on one side and an orange sac on the other side. And so I think what the beetle does is it mixes those two, whatever chemicals is in there together. And then I watched the beetles march in and out of hornets' nests, and they go up to it and then they back off from it. I mean, those beetles will go in and out of a hornet's nest. So then I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And then, and I'm making this quick, Larry, so then I noticed that they do have an arch enemy, and it turns out to be mice. When the beetles all, because it would snow out on my farm up there with beetles. You couldn't go outside, and they'd bite you in the neck. And So, but in the fall, they would congregate into clusters for the winter. And I noticed that the mice would go in and only eat the abdomen, but not the head part where those glands are in there. Okay, so that's that. And the mosquitoes, I missed your dragonfly show the last time. And I tried calling in, but I noticed that every time a dragonfly makes contact with the mosquito in flight, as soon as they make contact, the wings fall off. They literally clip the wings off the mosquito on contact. So I wanted to throw those couple things in there. And then the mosquitoes here, I'll end it with this. The mosquitoes here are carrying signs now, and the sign says, "We want to do more COVID testings."
All right. Chris, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Well, we had a couple of things we can talk about there, PJ.
Yeah, so those Asian lady beetles, that's the species that likes to sneak indoors in the fall, especially like early October a lot of years. And they're simply seeking out sheltered overwintering spots. Now, from their point of view, they would want to get into a sheltered spot, and often they'll sneak under your siding or up in soffit areas, things like that. And they would really like to hunker down for the winter. And then when things warm up in spring, they leave again. They really don't want to be active during the winter months because they're burning through the energy reserves that they have. So if they do accidentally make it indoors to living quarters, it's a rather harsh environment for them. They don't have food sources, which they feed on other insects. They are losing moisture to the air, and so it's no surprise that if presented with water, they might drink some of that up, because desiccation is a major threat to them when they are in very dry indoor environments. In terms of the dark-colored chemical that they can secrete, this is true of Asian lady beetles, and other lady beetles can do this. There's a phenomenon called reflex bleeding. And they actually ooze out their insect blood called hemolymph, and there are defensive chemicals in that. So it's going to taste really bad. It's going to have an odor associated with it, and that orangish-reddish liquid can actually stain things as well. So that's a common defense that certain lady beetles use.
Very interesting. Well, let's take another call. Jake in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jake.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually have two things. I don't know if with people in line if you want to take them on, but one issue is I had quite a few iris plants, and something has been happening with the leaves where they kind of get yellowish and then they turn into like brown streaks, and it's kind of destroyed the iris. I don't know if it's an insect or a virus. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe you can address that.
Could be an iris borer. Yeah, go ahead. What was your other question?
That looks like. And then the other part is that I have quite a few dogwoods, and I have found underneath the leaves where there are some, they've been putting holes all over the place, but there are clusters of white, tiny caterpillars that have black spots on them that are kind of curled up under the leaves. I wondered if you could tell me what those would be.
All right. PJ, what do you think? We've got iris borer issues, or iris issues, and then we've got the dogwood problem.
Yeah, so I suspect you're right, Larry, with the iris. I'm suspicious of iris borer, which is actually a caterpillar. And they overwinter on plants as eggs, and then in the springtime, those eggs hatch and the caterpillars tunnel into plants. You can get some discoloration on the leaves, and eventually they can get into some of the below ground structures and really cause some significant plant damage there. We do have some sprays available that can help. The main important point, though, is that you have to do it at the right time of the year, which would be in spring, before the caterpillars get into the plants. Once they're inside the plant, they're pretty well protected, and it's very hard to target them. I will mention we do actually have UW Extension fact sheet on iris borers. So what I'd encourage a listener to do is hop online and search for iris borer Wisconsin Extension, And you should be able to find our fact sheet on that particular insect. And then it'll talk much more about the specifics of what you can use and other control tactics and approaches there. So that's the helpful thing I would point out for that iris spore. Regarding the other one, it was a dogwood, correct?
Yeah, with some white caterpillar type.
Yeah. So what I think is going on in this case, that sounds like a creature called the dogwood sawfly to me. And this is actually a relative of ants and wasps and bees, although the larvae do have a very caterpillar-like appearance, and they can vary a little bit in color. Sometimes they're yellowish and blackish. Sometimes they're covered with a whitish, waxy coating, and you can see some black on there as well. And they often like to hang out on the undersides of leaves. They can be very common, starting about this time of the year and going on through late summer and into early fall. And they will sometimes defoliate dogwood shrubs entirely, so they can be problematic in that regard. So if you have seen them previously, what I would do is for dogwoods in my yard, start scouting this time of the year. And one very helpful thing you could do would be to flip over some leaves and look for the insects. Or if you put down something like a piece of cardboard and slide it underneath the canopy of the dogwood shrub and give the bush a good shake, some of them may fall down onto the cardboard below. And if you see those, you know they're active. They're not that hard to kill. You can use organic options like insecticidal soap or neem oil or pyrethrins or spinosad. You just have to make sure to spray the undersides of the leaves where they like to hide out.
There we go. Thank you so much for that question. PJ Leash, our guest today, he is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects today on the program, Larry Mueller here with my guest, PJ Leash of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always great to have him come by, and thanks so much for listening in. Our lines are filled, so we'll go back to the phones, and Cheryl in New Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Yes, my question is, I've noticed we have so many dragonflies. They're all over the place. I walk all over town. And they're just sitting on everything, hanging on the screens, and I was wondering if you knew why.
All right. Why all the dragonflies?
Well, that's a good question. My impression is that it does seem to be a decent year for dragonfly. I've been seeing a lot of them just around my backyard near our raised bed gardens and things like that. But it's not too surprising given the time of the year. We do have an awful lot of dragonfly species out in the state. Some of these species stay closer to home, so to speak. So if they emerge from a particular pond or a particular lake or stream, they may stay relatively close by and not fly that far. But we do have some other dragonfly species that can wander greater distances, sometimes miles and miles away from their water sources. So it's possible that you might have just seen one of these species that is capable of a lot more movement coming through your area. Or it's possible if you have a body of water relatively close for you, to you within a quarter mile, half mile, something like that, you might be seeing some dragonfly species associated with that body of water that just happen to be passing through your backyard looking for some food. So I think it's mostly that it's the time of the year. We're just in peak dragonfly season at the moment.
There you go, Cheryl. Thank you. Glenn in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. My problem is with a magnolia bush. It's an older one, but I noticed, I think you call it scale. And I had that a few years ago. And once that thing gets going, it rains underneath that. Is there any way I can do anything myself without having it sprayed?
Yes, so a couple things. And the insect you're referring to is called magnolia scale. And as you mentioned, we did see a peak of activity a few years ago in the state, I'd say 3-4 years ago. And then I started getting rumblings last summer about this time from arborists and tree care professionals. And I've been getting a lot of reports thus far this summer suggesting that populations of that insect are on the upswing at the moment. So other listeners that are out there and have magnolias in your yard, I keep a close eye on them because this can be a rather challenging pest to deal with. Now, the story with scale insects is they kind of hunker down and pick a spot, and they secrete a waxy coating that covers their body. So that makes them more challenging to control. Now, a couple of things you could try. If the particular magnolia isn't that large, you could try physical removal. That would be essentially rubbing or scraping these insects off gently. The problem is that these insects, they drink plant sap. They have these little slender mouth parts like a hypodermic needle. So they're drinking the sap specifically, and they're not able to digest all the sugars. So their excrement, which we call honeydew, is loaded with sugar. And so when that drips down, that makes a sticky mess. So if you're trying to squish or rub these off, it will be a messy situation, but that could be a consideration. Otherwise, if you wait until the right time of the year, we can kill the juvenile stages. The juvenile stages, when they hatch out of the egg, we call those crawlers because they're actually mobile and wander around at that point. And they're relatively easy to kill because they don't have a tough waxy coating. The catch is that those crawlers are out late in summer, as in the very end of August and beginning of September is the appropriate time to target those. And so in theory, you can kill those crawler stages with organic options like insecticidal soap or pyrethrins. You could use a conventional tree or shrub spray at that time. It's that timing that's the critical factor there. If a plant does have a very serious infestation of magnolia scale, there are some other things we can do. We can try a dormant oil during late fall or early spring before the plant has leaves on it again to essentially smother those insects. That's another approach that could be taken. Or in some cases, we may have to use a systemic product that we apply to the soil and move upwards to target those if it's a very, very heavy infestation on the tree. So those are some things that could be tried. I will mention that we do also have a University of Wisconsin Division of Extension fact sheet on magnolia scale. So if you'd look like some additional information, hop online and you should be able to find that. And it'll discuss, the timing and different management approaches.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. Scale is miserable on any plant. Have it on limey, and it's been my lime tree, and it's not been pretty, for sure.
Yeah, they definitely can be frustrating to deal with because that waxy protective coating means that most sprays aren't going to work unless you time it just right.
Yeah. Janet in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. I have a question about mosquitoes again. We know that they carry diseases and things like West Nile virus. So I'm wondering if they can transmit coronavirus. And if not, I'm curious why. And I'll take an answer off the air. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. So that's a good question. I have received that question quite a few times over the last couple of months. And at this point, we have no evidence that mosquitoes would transmit COVID or coronavirus at this time. It's a disease that is transmitted primarily through respiratory droplets and things like that, rather than a bloodborne disease that we know of at this point. For a mosquito to actually transmit a disease, a lot of things have to happen. First of all, the mosquito would have to be able to pick it up with a blood meal. The disease would then have to be able to survive within the mosquito. That means going through the gut and not being broken down by enzymes and other things of that nature. It would then have to be able to not only survive, but reproduce within the mosquito, and then also move to a location in the mosquito that it would be able to leave the mosquito again. So basically, it would have to make its way up to the salivary gland. So you have this long chain of events that would have to happen for a mosquito to actually transmit a disease. And if at any one of those stages that chain is broken, we don't get transmission. So we do know from previous diseases and viruses like MERS and SARS, we didn't see any type of vector-borne arthropod transmission. And so we don't have any evidence at this point that mosquitoes would spread coronavirus.
Okay, let's go to Vicki in Duluth, Minnesota now. Hi, Vicki.
Hi there. So my daughter just bought a house in April in Duluth, and it has a vernal pond. And I got her some BT donuts to kill the mosquito larvae, but she's worried that then the frogs won't have anything to eat. And the frogs are a big deal here.
Okay, what do you think, PJ?
Yeah, so what the caller described, these BT dunks, and what BT is, BT is short for Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a particular type of bacteria that happens to produce a protein that is toxic to insects. Now, the thing about BT is there are different strains of BT, and each works against specific types of insects. So what's used in the mosquito dunks is BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis is the strain associated with it, and that only works against larvae of true flies, insects from the order Diptera. So this group does include mosquitoes. It would include a few other aquatic flies like midges and things like that, but it's not going to harm other non-fly insects in that body of water. So if we have true bugs, water boatmen and giant water bugs and things like that, it wouldn't have an impact on those. So it may reduce those mosquito larvae, but I suspect there will be some other things, other insects that those frogs would be able to feed on in that pond.
There you go, Vicki. Thank you for calling. And Patricia in Baraboo. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you very much. So we have a small open porch that my partner wanted to do some work on, and he discovered a wasp's nest, and he got bit twice, and we would like to get rid of the nest. And I did read, wait till at night and then put a bag around it and move it, but my partner was thinking maybe he could set up a sprinkling system, you know, like put a ladder and put a hose with a sprinkler on it, and then he would maybe they would just go away. We don't necessarily want to kill them, but we would like them gone before the winter.
Okay, so this then is an exposed aerial nest with the paper mache type construction?
Correct. It's in a corner by the ceiling of this open porch, small open porch.
Okay, gotcha. I simply wanted to ask to make sure, because some of our yellow jackets will actually nest internally inside of wall voids and things like that, and there's different approaches to dealing with those. So the story with these aerial nesting yellow jackets, and it's the same story essentially with paper wasps, is the colonies start out in spring, and they're built by queens that mated last year and survived through the winter in sheltered spots. And so that queen has to come out, build her nest from scratch, and then the nest is going to continue to increase in size throughout the growing season, and then it's going to reach peak size in late summer or early fall. So given the time of the year, it may be relatively small, but if you don't do anything, it's going to get larger. And depending on the species, if it's something like bald-faced hornet, which are larger and black and white species of yellow jackets, those nests can sometimes approach the size of a basketball. So you can have thousands of workers present, and that could be a potentially dangerous situation. So given the location on your home, you know, it would make sense to do something sooner rather than later when that nest gets any larger. In terms of what you could do, in theory, if you went up at night and put a bag around it, I've done that myself with small yellow jacket nests, but you will probably, you know, wake them up, so to speak, and they're not going to be happy about it. So you'd have to be quick and be very careful putting the bag around it. And if it's up on a ladder or anything, you know, that's just not a good situation to do. In terms of hooking up a sprinkler system, that's a good question in terms of if it would work or not. I have not heard of folks trying that, but if you're getting the water close enough, it may deter them to the point that they may abandon the nest. Although if they abandon the nest, I don't necessarily expect them to survive in the long run because, again, they try establishing those nests in the spring months, And for them to succeed that year, they really need to build it up over the course of several months. So that may deter them, but again, it may essentially doom that colony. Otherwise, a standard approach would be to use an aerosol or a foam wasp spray from the hardware store, and it really wouldn't take much. Just a little bit of direct spray to the nest would take out the nest in a situation like this. So those are some options of what you could try.
There you go,
Patricia.
What is
I don't understand the foam spray. What is that? Can you just talk about that a little bit more?
Sure. So if you go to the hardware store, they have some different types of wasp sprays. They have some that are just a pure aerosol droplet. They have some that foam up on contact. So if you were to spray it directly into the entrance of the nest, that liquid is going to instantly expand and foam up. And that way, if the insects are trying to get out, they're going to have to move through that foamy mass and get a lot more contact from that particular insecticide.
All right. There you go, Patricia. Thank you so much. Diana in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Nice to talk to you. We have these little worms that we started to get last year, and they crawled up the rain barrel, and it looked like they were just going into the opening of the rain barrel. I had the rain barrel there for about 5 years, never saw them before, but then found out they ended up in the basement, and there were hundreds of them. And I know that there have been people were talking about having these in their basements as well. And first, somebody said they might be millipede. I'm getting confused, the larvae or pupa stage. I forgot which comes worst. But could be the millipedes. I didn't see any millipedes in the basement last winter. And so first, I'm interested to know what they are. But more importantly, I would really like to not have them be in the basement. I don't care if they stay out on the rain barrel, but I want them out. I did put down a lot of salt, which killed them and kept them from, you know, going any farther because I didn't want to spray a lot of spray.
Mm-hmm.
But so there you go. What do I do to get rid of them?
What do you think, PJ?
Sure. Well, given the description and also the time of the year, I'm very, very suspicious that they may be millipedes. And the story with millipedes is that they are associated with damp areas. They love to feed on decaying plants. So if you have dense flower beds or plant beds, mulch beds, things like that, if you're near a wooded area, it can be good millipede habitat. If you have agriculture, fields around you or pastures or CRP land, that can also be very good habitat for millipedes. Now, the thing about millipedes is that when we get to this time of the year, I often see this phenomenon where they start to wander, and they can wander very, very long distances. I mean, they could easily cross your yard and go into the neighbor's yard. So they're able to move some long distances, primarily at night, though. They are very sensitive to drying out, so millipedes don't like to be out on the sidewalk during bright sunny days and things like that. They prefer rainy overcast days, or they're very active after dark. So they're out there, they're wandering around. Sometimes this seems to be triggered by rainfall events. So if you get a heavy rainfall where we get a couple inches of rain, that seems to kind of spur them to move. I don't know if they're trying to leave areas that are waterlogged and looking for drier areas or what the exact cause is. But if they get up to structures, they can easily sneak in. And they often will get into areas like basements or garages. Indoors, they can't survive at all. It's way too dry for them. So they're essentially doomed when they get inside, but they can be a bit of a nuisance. For the ones that are in the basement, I wouldn't really recommend any type of spraying in the basement at all, because once they get in, they're not going to survive long. I would simply vacuum or sweep them up, the ones that you found indoors. Where I would focus my attention, though, would be on the exterior of your home, because these, again, are outdoor creatures. They'll accidentally sneak in. So if we can get down, and you might have to get down on hands and knees and look and see, are there cracks or gaps on your foundation of your home? Perhaps it's something where a window well needs better weather stripping or something of that nature. If we can find these access points and seal them up with weather stripping, caulk, expanding insulation foam from a spray can or things of that nature, and physically seal things up, then they won't be able to get in. So that's the ultimate long-term solution, is fill in all those cracks and gaps that will keep them outdoors. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes I realize that's much more easily said than done. So, you know, fill up as many gaps and cracks as you can. Sometimes another approach would be to use an insecticide just along the bottom of the foundation of your house. The idea being that if we can kill them before they sneak inside, that can prevent some of those issues. But I'd also encourage you to take a look at your yard and see, do you have good millipede habitat? If you have a lot of flower beds or plant beds with very dense vegetation, thinning out some of the plants and getting more airflow through there, drying things out a bit, that's going to reduce millipede habitat, and that may also help in a situation like this. So there's quite a few different things you can do around your house and in your yard, both chemical and non-chemical, that should help.
There you go, Diana. Thank you so much for calling. Well, Chris in Adams has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hello. I have two suggestions, and then I want to talk about monarch butterflies. The first one is that for the guy with the irises, if it's too late in the season to spray, what you should do is dig everything up and make a solution of a cup of chlorine bleach to a gallon of water, and put them in for 10 minutes. That'll kill everything on them. And then turn over your bed and replace the soil and try and redo it. The second thing is I saw something very interesting on the internet. The woman was having some real bad trouble with wasp nests on her house. They were like under the eaves and stuff. And what she did was she crocheted. She found out that wasps are very territorial. And so she crocheted great big huge wasp nests to put them up where the wasps were nesting, and the wasps never came back. So that's another suggestion. You got to be creative. I want to talk about monarchs because the baby caterpillars are out on the milkweed right at this very moment as we speak. And monarch caterpillars have a 90% mortality rate, and we got to get the populations up. And so people are building butterfly houses, and they're taking them into their house to raise them or doing it out in their backyard or whatever. And so we need to help them, but you have to have – it's a project. This is like having a pet. You have to clean up after them. You have to take care of them. And it's a great project because everybody's at home with their kids, and you can get these little – houses to bring in the house, and it's a miracle thing. Metamorphosis is a miracle thing, and then you can let your kids let them go in the fall, and I think that that's a really positive thing. So
there you go.
To do.
Something to do. Well, PJ, what do you think?
Well, you know, it is interesting with this whole coronavirus situation going on, and a lot of folks are at home, and if you have kids, you know, you're home with the kids and maybe looking for activities for them to do. And so I think it's a great suggestion. You know, if you were to bring in a couple of monarch caterpillars and you can watch them and the kids can learn about life cycles and insect metamorphosis and development, that could be a great educational opportunity for them. And then you can let them go outdoors when you're done. So I do think it is a very neat activity for kids to be able to observe. Now, in terms of monarchs in general, as the caller mentioned, monarch caterpillars have a very high mortality rate. There's all kinds of things that eat them. There are diseases they can come down sick with. And so we do end up losing an awful lot of monarch caterpillars. So if we want to help out monarchs, what we really need across a wide scale is folks just to plant more milkweed plants. And then we'll have more caterpillars out there, and that may help. So, you know, if you want to help out monarchs, you certainly can bring some indoors and raise them to a certain extent. It can be a lot of work. If you are raising multiple caterpillars, it's best to keep them in separate containers in case one has a disease. It's not going to spread it to others. So all of a sudden, if you just have one or two, that's pretty easy. But if you're raising dozens of caterpillars, that's a lot of work and a lot of room to do that. But another thing you can do in your own yard is simply planting milkweed plants and then planting other flowering plants that can serve as nectar sources for the adults. And that doesn't necessarily have to be milkweed. The adults go to a very, very wide range of flowering plants.
There we go. Thank you again for that call. I appreciate it very much. Our guest today, PJ Leash, he is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, P.J. Leash, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Talking the world of insects with him. Our lines are all filled. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear you that way as well. The number is 800-642-1234. And since we have so many callers online, let's go back to the phones. Richard in Two Rivers is up next. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Caught like six fish today. They're really nice. They're rainbows. And that's besides the point. I have two questions. My first question is, how many West Nile viruses were contracted in Wisconsin last year? And I had a patient that was her husband that contracted the West Nile virus, and they ended up being wheelchair bound because of neurological conditions. And I just wanted to hear PJ's comments.
All right. Thank you, Richard. PJ, what do you think? How many cases did we have last year of West Nile? Do you know?
I just quickly pulled up the stats from Wisconsin Department of Health Services. They do have publicly available data for diseases like West Nile, and it'll give you the caseload by year. And what I recalled is that we really didn't have many last year, and West Nile caseload varies quite a bit from year to year. And so when I have the data up here for 2019, there were only two human confirmed cases and no deaths recorded in 2019. So a relatively low year. If you look back historically, we do see some peaks from time to time. Our highest year in the last decade or so was actually back in the year 2012. And if listeners remember the summer of 2012, for a lot of Wisconsin, it was a very, very dry, droughty year. And that year we saw almost 60 confirmed West Nile cases in the state. So it's a little bit counterintuitive in terms of West Nile cases. You would think intuitively, if we have more rain, we should have more mosquitoes, therefore we should get more West Nile, but it doesn't work like that. Turns out that the mosquitoes that are really good are playing an important role in transmitting West Nile in the state are species like Culex pipiens, the northern house mosquito. This mosquito loves to hang out in urban or suburban areas, especially in wastewater runoff catch basins. These would be little cisterns associated with water runoff systems in urban areas, and there's a catch basin in there that fills up with water. And so those particular mosquitoes do very well in those situations. Well, if you have a heavy rainfall, it actually flushes them out and they die. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, but in rainy years, we tend to see fewer West Nile cases versus very dry years. We would expect a spike in a case like that. So only two human cases last year, which was good news. But in terms of the symptoms described, I mean, West Nile virus can cause some very, very significant symptoms to individuals affected by it, and including death. So it can be a severe disease.
So there you go, Richard. We haven't had any shortage of rain and water so this year. So maybe the numbers will be down again this year as well. Hopefully that's the case. Dot in Chippewa Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I have a couple questions for you. One is, I heard you talking about pyrethrin spray for caterpillars. Can I use it now? Because I got a lot of caterpillars on my plants. They're chewing on the leaves and stuff.
Yes, so I had mentioned earlier pyrethrins, which are an organic spray that you can get at a lot of hardware stores and garden centers. These pyrethrins come from a natural extract from certain types of chrysanthemums, and these pyrethrins happen to have insecticidal properties. They can work against a very wide range of insects, including caterpillars. I would keep in mind, though, if I'm seeing caterpillars on a plant, if the caterpillars are really large, and some species of caterpillars can get to be an inch or 2 inches long, it's not going to work very well against those, simply because those caterpillars are larger, harder to kill. But if you're seeing small caterpillars of a pest species, pyrethrins can work well against those. And what's nice about the pyrethrins is they break down very, very quickly in sunlight. So you use them, and when within about a day or so, they're broken down and gone. So they do have that very favorable aspect about them.
Yeah, makes good sense. Dot, thank you. Suzanne in West Bend, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Sort of a twofold question. Last year, we heard a lot about the devastation of insects, that they are just not there, and I've noticed that myself. And
Oh, we must have lost her. Well, the problem of fewer insects, PJ.
Yeah, so this is something that we are hearing more and more about is general insect declines. And this is something that I have noticed a lot more news reports about over the last 4 or 5 years. There have been some big review studies that have come out. And so undoubtedly, there are insect declines going on. A complicating factor is that these declines don't seem to have one single cause. If that were the case, it would be much easier to correct the problem. Instead, it's a whole bunch of interacting factors, and it's hard to tease out which of the factors are most important, how much those factors are contributing. It's things such as land use changes. And I like to tell folks, you know, imagine if we could have a satellite view of Wisconsin today compared to 200 years ago. You know, 200 years ago, there would have been a lot more green out there. We have, changed habitat to build homes, build stores and things like that, build roadways. We have shifted towards monoculture agriculture in a lot of situations. And so we have taken the landscape and made it much simpler in that regard. So that's one important factor. There are other things such as pesticide use in the environment. And some pesticides can be very, very broad spectrum and long lasting and can have impacts on a wide range of insects. There are diseases that can affect insects. There are issues related to environmental pollution and light pollution, things like that. So undoubtedly, there are a lot of things contributing to this insect decline. And it's very concerning because we rely on insects for a lot of important things like pollination services, biological control, attacking pest insects, for example. We've got beneficial predators and parasites. And then we've got a lot of insects that are essentially recyclers. They help break down nutrients from dead plants or dead animals and return those nutrients to the soil. So it very much is an alarming situation that we're seeing these declines.
Let's take another call. Camille in New Berlin, we'll go to you. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have some bumblebees that have nested directly under my deck, and I'm pretty sure there's nothing I can do about them now without killing them. But how can I discourage the queen from coming back next year?
Oh, great question. So first of all, regarding the situation, you are correct. There's not going to be a whole lot you can do this year in terms of relocating them. Bumblebee nests, by their very nature, they're somewhat messy and disorganized compared to like a honeybee colony where we have these nice rows of honeybee or honeycombs and things like that. Bumblebee nests, you have these little wax cells, some filled with young, some filled with food and things like that, and they're just kind of scattered. And so if you were to simply try to dig that out of their nesting location, you're going to end up causing a whole bunch of damage, and that colony almost certainly is going to die. So unfortunately, we don't have a good feasible way to really remove or relocate bumblebee colonies. So at this point, there's really two courses of action. One would be to simply wait it out and leave them be. That colony is going to die out on its own in the fall, probably sometime in October or so, depending on temperatures and things like that. Bumblebees have annual colonies. It's very similar, actually, to our social wasps, like yellow jackets. They overwinter as fertilized queens. those queens emerge in spring and then attempt to establish new nests. So if you can leave them be and kind of steer clear of the area, that's going to be best for that particular bumblebee colony. If it were in a spot where you just can't avoid them and there's going to be stings, you know, then we'd be talking about potentially treating that nest, which would, of course, kill the colony. We don't want to try and do that, of course. In terms of future nests and preventing them, one important thing is that bumblebee queens, when they come out of hibernation, they are looking for pre-existing cavities of one kind or another. So this could be an abandoned burrow from a chipmunk or ground squirrel or something like that. And so if you go around your yard, if you see little burrows like that in the ground, you can fill them in, especially doing this in the spring. That's going to eliminate those potential nesting sites, and so the bumblebees won't set up shop in a location like that. So that's something going forward into the future that you can do to hopefully prevent them from nesting in that same location.
Yeah. Could you screen the porch, too? Around the bottom.
Yeah, that's a possibility as well, because to get in and really look under a lot of decks, especially if it's like my deck and there's about a foot and a half of clearance, you can't get in there very easily. So in theory, if you had a fine enough screen and it were secured all the way around the deck so that bumblebees couldn't get in, that may be a way to deter them as well.
Our guest today is P.J. Leash. He has degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the UW and is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We will take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we'll be back with PJ. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Well, if you have a question about insects, you have come to the right place. Larry Mueller here, PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I hope you'll join in. If you have a question, the number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And PJ, Jennifer emailed that when she plucked the scapes from her hardneck garlic plants in June, she discovered a few of them were partially hollowed out by a caterpillar of some type, and wondering, is treatment generally recommended? She sent a photo of the caterpillar. She prefers to stay organic and wonders if the bulbs themselves are safe from the pests underground, or should she plan to be disappointed when she pulls them from the ground this week? Also, will the cloves be safe to eat?
Yeah, so good question. I did receive those photos, Larry. I'm taking a look at them right now, and what I'm seeing is a decent-sized caterpillar. I'm guessing it's probably over an inch or so long in the photo. What's really distinct about this caterpillar is it's got some dark kind of blackish and whitish stripes on the body, and what that tells me is this is a species from the genus Papapima. And we often refer to these as stalk borers. And there's a whole bunch of species out there in this group in our area, at least two dozen or so. But we have two species in particular, common stalk borer and one species called burdock borer, that are highly polyphagous, meaning they go to a very, very wide range of plants. So I have actually seen this particular caterpillar attacking, well, now garlic in this case, but I've seen it going after a wide range of other plants this year, things such as zinnia flowers and tomatoes and a number of other plants. What this particular insect does is the caterpillars tunnel into the above ground portions of the stem. So some good news is that I have a suspicion that the below ground structures of the garlic are probably going to be fine. I mean, if anything looks off, you know, you might not want to eat those, but I'm guessing that this caterpillar is probably strictly above ground. In terms of what you can do about it, there's not a whole lot you can do at this point. So with these caterpillars, the adult moths are out early in the year and they lay eggs. And once those eggs hatch, I'm sorry, the eggs overwinter, when those eggs hatch, though, the caterpillars tunnel into the stalks. And once they're inside, they're pretty well protected. And so we can use or try to use sprays, and it just isn't going to get to them because the caterpillars are inside the stalk. So often when I see these, if you have a patch of garlic or a patch of zinnias, it might be a stem here, a stem there, a stem there. But it usually isn't across the board every single stem. So that's some good news. You might lose a couple, but probably not lose all your plants. But in the grand scheme of things, we don't have a great way to protect against these because they can be very hit or miss, and they can vary a lot from year to year. And just because you saw these this year doesn't necessarily mean you'll have issues with them next year. So one thing you could do in that general area around your garden would be to get good weed control and pull a lot of the weeds, because the adults that are out later this year, they like to go to weedy plants to lay their eggs. And so if you get rid of the weeds, you won't have the eggs, hopefully. And then if those eggs don't overwinter, hopefully we won't have issues next year.
All right. Marcus in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was talking to my daughter the other day, and she started up a vegetable garden 2 or 3 years ago. And I asked her how it's doing, and she said that it's doing great, but there's something eating holes in some of the leaves. And she says there's tons of beetles. And I asked her to describe it, and it's a green. And I asked her, is it iridescent green, you know, real bright? And she said, yeah. And then, so I can't remember. I tried to Google it, you know, go to DNR, Wisconsin, or whatever. But anyway, what would be maybe the name of the beetle, but what would be their recommendation, you know, how to prevent it? She says they're all over the place.
Okay. And
Japanese beetles, specific, probably?
Yeah, that's my guess. Are they on specific plants?
Yeah, she told me. I can't remember. You know, we talked about quite a while. I think I knew you'd ask that question. Maybe the cucumbers, okay. And I don't know what. I can't remember, sir.
Okay. Well, as Larry mentioned, I think these are definitely Japanese beetles. And this is an insect species that can damage a very, very wide range of plants up there, including certain garden vegetables. And the reason I asked about what plants they're on, they're very fond of certain garden plants, and they don't care as much for others. So if I were to pick perhaps one of their favorite plants in the garden, I would pick something like pole beans that grow upwards and, you know, can be 6 or 8 feet tall. They really love plants like that. Couple things you can do to manage these in a vegetable garden, and this is going to be influenced by the amount of free time you have. If you're working from home due to COVID and you have more time to go out there once an hour or something and check on things, I mean, doing something as simple as hand picking or squishing them or knocking them into a container of soapy water can be very helpful, especially early on in the season. This insect starts popping out in about early July, and they're active for about 2+ months, so much of the rest of the summer. But it turns out when the Japanese beetles feed and damage plants, plants actually release volatile chemicals, and additional Japanese beetles can be attracted to that. So especially early in the season, if you do a lot of hand picking and prevent that initial damage, it's going to help reduce the number of additional beetles going to it. And that's been documented through some research studies. So that's one thing you could do, is physically removing them. Another option for certain plants, if they're not too big, you could consider covering them with a mesh fabric, floating row cover, we would call it. Although if it's a plant that needs pollinators to get in, then the pollinators would be cut off as well. So it wouldn't work in a case like that. But if it's something that doesn't need pollinator access, physically covering them with mesh netting can help. There are also some organic sprays. Things like azadirachtin and pyrethrins can help. There's a newer product out there which contains BT, which we discussed earlier in the show for mosquitoes. But for mosquitoes, we use BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israelensis is the strain. For Japanese beetles, there's a newer strain, a newer product out there, and it contains Bacillus thuringiensis gallerii, is the strain. So BTG, and that's an organic option that can work pretty well. Otherwise, if you go to the hardware store or garden center, most of the common garden insect sprays that you can get will also protect foliage from these insects as well. Just keep in mind that those products do break down, and so you're going to have to read the fine print on the container and follow the directions and see how often you can reapply them. So those are a number of different things that you can do in a vegetable garden to help with Japanese beetles.
There you go, Marcus. Thank you so much for calling. Betty in Dodgeville, on to you now. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I don't know if anyone else is as miserable as I am, but the chiggers are really, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm in tons of them on my body, and they itch, and I can't seem to stop getting them. What can I do?
Okay. Well, when it comes to chiggers, so chiggers are a certain type of mite, and really these mites are associated with other animals. So it could be wild animals, reptiles, and things like that. Now, overall, chiggers are not particularly common in Wisconsin. If you go to the south of us, like southern parts of the U.S., they can be a lot more common there. In terms of what you can do about chiggers, there isn't really any type of good way to eliminate them from a yard or property. Instead, the most effective things to do would be to focus on personal protection. So things such as long sleeve clothing could be helpful. Another thing that you could do would be to wear repellent, such as DEET can also help to a certain extent. And if you know that you keep encountering them when you go to a particular area, could be in your yard or somewhere else, if you think you're getting them from that particular area, when you're done visiting that location or hanging out in your yard or garden, come indoors and take a warm shower right away. The little mites try biting us. They realize we're not a good food source for them. And so if you wash them off, that can help detach them.
All right. A couple of suggestions there, Betty. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. I know how she feels. I've had chiggers too, and they're no fun. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. I would like PJ to identify a very small insect I call mini bees. They're probably the bodies about the size of a grain of rice. I think they've got a little yellow with very, very small, maybe stripes on, and they hover around like little helicopters right by you. They're very, very small.
Okay. Well, I wonder in this situation, we do have some wild bees that can be quite small, about that size. But based on the description, I actually wonder if these may be types of hoverflies. And there's an entire family of hoverflies, family Syrphidae, and they are these brightly colored, charismatic flies. They're harmless to people, but many of the species have rather distinctive black and yellow stripes on the body or black and yellow coloration. They're actually beneficial pollinators, so they do go to flowers and things like that. But an important clue in this case is simply the notion that these things hover around you, and that's often very true of these hoverflies. So, as I said, I think it may actually be a type of fly in this case rather than a bee. But what I would maybe suggest is hop on to Google or search for hoverflies and see if you can find some similar-looking photos, because based on the description, I think that's what you're seeing.
There you go, Lee. Thank you. Kathy in Eau Claire. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Recently, I was at a store in our town, and they had bee houses, and I'd never seen them before. They had little compartments, just like a 1-inch or half inch in diameter, little cylinders of wood in circles all throughout the little house, open from both ends. And I just wondered, are those a gimmick? Are they viable? In listening to the discussion about the bumblebees, I just wondered if that'd be an alternative to nature and maybe be a good resource. So I just wanted your opinion on those.
All right. What do you think, PJ?
Yes, so there are what we refer to as bee houses, or if it's a bigger one, sometimes folks call them bee hotels. And as the caller described, these are often made out of wood or bamboo. And the main feature of these is there are a bunch of tubes present. So it could be holes drilled into wood or bamboo or cardboard tubes. And if you look at bees overall in Wisconsin, so we've got between 400 and 500 different species of bees. We only have two types of truly social bees, honeybees and bumblebees. And those bees wouldn't have an interest in a bee house like this. The vast majority of our bee species, though, are wild, solitary creatures. And what that means is that these insects like to nest in tubes of one kind or another. And about two-thirds of these species nest in the ground, so they wouldn't be interested. They're looking for sandy soil that's easy to dig in, and those are really harmless, beneficial creatures because they each nest alone and they're not defensive. But about a third of our bees like to nest in pre-existing tubes. And out in nature, this might be a hollow plant stem, or if you prune a shrub and you look and something is tunneled into the pithy middle of the stem, some of these insects will do that. They could also go to a rotting log or a standing dead tree that has a pre-existing tunnel from another insect where a borer emerged, for example. So these insects like to go to these tubes, and they're going to create their nest there. And each female creates her own nest. She has to stockpile it with enough food for her young, so pollen and nectar. And then what she does is she builds off little individual cells or little homes for these bees, if you will. So inside each of the tube, she may provision a bunch of little chambers, 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 of these inside those tubes. So if you get one of these bee houses and you put it out in your yard near a flower bed, for example, there are things such as mason bees and leafcutter bees and some other bees that can use this as potential nesting habitat. There's also some wasps, solitary wasps, that will use them as well. So it does provide some habitat, although we do need some more research on the topic. There have been some concerns expressed if you use a bee house season after season and you don't change things out, is there a possibility for a buildup of disease, microbes, or parasites, or things like that? So I have one of these bee houses in my own yard, and I use, you can buy, pre-made little cardboard tubes, and I can change those out from year to year, which would minimize the chances of parasites or diseases building up on those. But the caller is absolutely right. These bee houses or bee hotels can provide habitat for some species of our wild bees.
Kathy, thank you for calling. Audrey emailed to ask the difference between horsefly and a deer fly. If there aren't any horses around, there must be a deer fly. Is that true? And how can you get them out of your yard?
Well, so it turns out deer flies and horseflies are actually very closely related to one another. They're in the same family, the family Tabanidae. So they have a lot of similarities anatomically. In general, deer flies are going to be smaller. A lot of our deer flies are maybe a quarter of an inch or so long, whereas a lot of our horse flies are going to be larger than that. We do have some big ones. Our largest in the state, Tabana citratus, the all-black horse fly, can be about an inch or so long and rather intimidating in appearance. You don't actually have to have any horses or livestock around to have either of these, though. The main factor with horse and deer flies is that they like marshy habitat. They lay eggs on plants in these habitats, and that's where the larvae develop. So if you are near a bunch of lakes and wetlands and marshes and things like that, you're just in good habitat for deer flies and horse flies, versus if you are in an area away from that type of habitat, you probably won't see nearly as many of them. So that's the main thing. But anatomically, the way to tell them apart, I go mostly by size and coloration. A lot of our horse flies tend to be black and brown color. A lot of our common deer flies tend to have some yellowish on the body. And then the size is an easy way to tell them apart.
Kathy, thank you. Benji in Harrisville, your turn. Hi, Benji.
Hey, Larry, I got ground bees. I was wondering if it's a safe way to get rid of ground bees.
Okay, so by ground bees, do you mean you have a single hole in the ground with a bunch of black and yellow things flying out of it?
Yeah, they're making a little burrow holes there.
Okay, and they're not bumblebees, are they?
No, they're little ones, little more black. They're not bumblebees.
Okay. The reason I wanted to ask about that, and I mentioned this just a couple of minutes ago, with our bees in Wisconsin, we really only have two main types of social bees, our honeybees, which wouldn't nest in the ground, bumblebees, which do nest in the ground. So based on the description, you actually aren't seeing bees in this case. What you're seeing would be ground nesting yellow jackets, most likely. Because if it's a nest in the ground with a bunch of insects living together in a colony, and we know it's not bumblebees, it would have to be those yellow jackets. So it's actually not ground bees in this case. When I think of ground bees, I think of solitary nesters where each female has her own nest, and she really is not defensive whatsoever. In terms of ground nesting yellow jackets, these insects create new nests every spring, and they build up and reach peak size in late summer. So that nest has been there for probably a month or two, and it probably has gone unnoticed until perhaps recently. That nest is going to continue to get larger and larger as the weeks go by. And so that can pose additional hazards if you're in the area mowing or whatnot or working in that area. In terms of what you can do about it, when we have ground nests for yellow jackets, the aerosol wasp sprays don't work very well because a little droplet settle. And so if you were to use that, you'll notice the next day they're active again and it didn't seem to faze them. What tends to work better in these situations, if you can find a dust or powder type product, either at the hardware store or ordering it online, that can be applied with a bulb duster where you puff the product into the nest entrance, and then as those insects come and go, they're going to track it in and wipe out the colony. Another option, you can find these at most hardware stores. It looks like an aerosol can, but it's an expanding foam product, and you can direct it down into the nest. Best to do this at night, especially if it's a cooler night where temperatures are maybe down in the 60s because they'll be much less active then. And you can spray this expanding foam into the entrance of the nest. It's going to very rapidly expand and fill up that area, and that usually does the trick pretty quickly.
There you go, Benji. Thank you so much for calling. And Joe and below, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Oh, hi. Somehow, some way, I got 14 Japanese beetles in my house. And yesterday morning, I found them on my tame onion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the tame onion, they were chewing on the onion, and the onion killed the beetles.
Did the onion kill them, PJ, or did something else?
Well, yeah, it does make me wonder a bit. I mean, Japanese beetles, I truly think of as being outdoor creatures. Could they, accidentally sneak in through an open door window or something like that? You know, that's always a possibility. I have not heard of any type of onion extract necessarily being toxic to them. I might wonder to a certain extent if the dry conditions indoors might have been really harsh on them, because if they're losing moisture to the air, that can be really hard on them. They could potentially die from that. I'd expect that to probably take a couple of days, but in this case, it's really hard, I think, to tell what ultimately did those beetles in.
PJ, we are out of time, and we had lots of emails that we didn't get to, but it's always a pleasure to have you with us. You're back October 21st, and we'll do this all over again. Thanks, PJ.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry.
PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back October 21st, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at adult dentistry, and then at 11:45, a look at masks, why they help control viruses and which work best. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, hey, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.